member. We have saved a 12-year-old girl. She was under the rubble for almost 30 hours. Unfortunately, she has lost all of her family. And now she is currently sheltering inside the hospital. Our psychosocial support team try as much as they can to support her, but no words can describe the traumatized situation that this 13-year-old girl, along with other children in Gaza, are living because of this intense bombardments. Even though those who didn't lose anyone, simply being under intense bombardments day and night and hearing strong bombardments with complete darkness because of the cut of electricity is just so much horrifying and panic among those children who are living unprecedented situations that no child in this world we wish is believing.
Well, first off, we want to thank you for spending this time with us. Spokesperson for the Palestine Red Crescent Society, joining us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Coming up, we'll speak to the Palestinian-American poet and physician, Fadi Judah. Israel's killed dozens of his family members in Gaza in just the past month. Stay with us.
ثوري ثوري قومي 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 إجا وقتك تثوري انت اللي قاعد غاب طافني كل اليوم بالشباك ترديش عحد وشو ما يحكوا لك وشو ما يحكوا عليكي انت هقوى من الكلام
by Mesa Dahl. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
As we continue to look at Israel's bombardment of Gaza, we're joined in Houston, Texas, by Fadi Judah. He's an award-winning Palestinian-American writer and poet, as well as a physician. He's translated several collections of poetry from Arabic into English, including work by the renowned Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. Dozens of his family members have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. His recent piece for Lit Hub is titled A Palestinian Meditation in a Time of Annihilation. Fadi Judah, welcome to Democracy Now! First of all, of course, our condolences on the loss of your family members. If you could say a little bit about those family members and how you and your family here in the U.S. are keeping in touch with people who remain in Gaza.
Thank you. Now, we have had more than 50 or 60 people in our extended family killed by Israeli airstrikes. Some of them are in-laws of one of my cousins, and others are different families. Others were also killed by the dozens in one strike. One particular story is of a woman I knew since when I was a child in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and her brother's grandkids were killed because Israel bombed the house next to them, and in the bombing, one of the walls of their house fell off on them, and they were sleeping, and it killed the three grandchildren and the parents, and only the grandfather survives. So this is also a different spectrum of what we hear about the children being the only survivors in entire families. there are also stories of elderly people who have survived 1948, the Nakba, and or 1967, and they're the only ones who are surviving or who have survived their families. We try to keep in touch with some family members through, you know, social media or WhatsApp or what have you. But you know, there's no guarantee that there is regular access or regular communication. You can send a message and maybe get a response the next day. In the beginning of the war, we could get a few phone calls in, but this stuff now is just very difficult to access. Many people. The situation is unspeakable and will remain unspeakable, I think, for generations and decades. Has been a culmination of the Palestinian experience for 100 years since the British Mandate and the beginning of settler colonialism with Zionist immigration into Palestine. It is really beyond words to describe what it means to be a Palestinian in this moment. The accumulation of multi-generational trauma and memories that activates in each one of us. Previous memories we've tried to overcome with hope and a flair for life and for freedom, only to find that there is always some horrific episode that reminds us that we are on this earth, in this time, liable to be massacred and lied about.
Speaking of which, Fadi, we're speaking to Fadi Judah, who is an award-winning Palestinian-American writer and poet and physician. As you speak to us from Houston, we've spoken to so many Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank as well. But you are here in the United States, and the United States is so important when it comes to how Israel deals with Palestine because of the amount of aid to the tune of billions of dollars a year and is now asking for much more. Can you talk about how the media here covers this issue?
Well, it's how the media doesn't cover it. I think that I've written in the piece there, and I've written in other pieces before, there is a collective psychosis in the mainstream language of U.S. media and administration that is bizarre to the point of ghosting Palestinians, permitting their erasure year after year, decade after decade. When we say, for example, Israel has a right to defend itself, we're also saying that Palestinian lives are not equal to any other lives that we deem superior to them. And I think that we have not repeatedly asked the question in American media and culture, do you believe that Palestinian lives are equal to Israeli lives and to Jewish lives? There are many Jewish people among them who believe the answer is yes, but there are many more who haven't even entertained the question honestly. And I think the importance of the question is to go beyond the moral lip service reflex of saying, of course, yes, because to say yes means that you have to believe in the equal humanity of Palestinians as a political condition for freedom. When we hear about all the stuff from Blinken or Biden, it is really a language that says we believe that the Palestinians have rights. When we decide that they have equal rights, we will put it on the back burner, always on the back burner. And what I say is that we have reached a point where the murder and the destruction of Palestinian lives has reached a point of every time it reaches, it goes up higher, escalates in what is permissible about destroying Palestinian lives. We're not just talking about the numbers of the dead. We are talking about 2 million people who are living a life worse than death, and they have to overcome that. And the trauma of that is unspeakable. And I do not expect the U.S. media and mainstream media or politics to even care about this. The ghosting continues. Yesterday in the Washington Post, they published a racist cartoon in which they took down because there was an immediate lashing out at the racist cartoon. It is unimaginable to think that this, and it shouldn't be imaginable, to think that this would be directed at Jewish lives or Israeli lives. But it is permissible to dehumanize Palestinians until it has become part of the accepted feeling within the American psyche or consciousness on the whole. And so everyone, I think, on the whole, except pockets here and there, is really complicit in the permissibility of the destruction of Palestinian lives that has reached an unprecedented level in our 100 years of being massacred, displaced, dehumanized.
Well, Fadi, I want to ask you about a point that you raise in this beautiful essay that you've written, A Palestinian Meditation in a Time of Annihilation. In the essay, you cite Aimé Césaire, the renowned Martinican poet, very important anti-colonial thinker who wrote one of the canonical texts on colonialism, A Discourse on Colonialism. You cite him saying, neither America nor Europe seem able or willing to solve their colonial addiction, their civilizational motif. Israel is a translation of that failure, a prized Western desire. But Israel has agency in mechanizing this desire. Could you explain, elaborate on that?
Well, I think that for some of us who know or don't know that the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 was a response to the Zionist movement in Europe by a Jewish people in Europe who had suffered a lot of oppression. But to overcome that oppression, they chose to side with the colonial aspect, the domineering aspect of the culture that dominated them, and export that as a mode for success and triumph into a Palestine without much recognition of the racism involved in dehumanizing what they call the Arab population of Palestine. And since then, it has been in the interest of the West and the U.S. to prop up Israel as a an outpost, so to speak, for further domination of the Middle East for various reasons. But the problem is that this kind of propping up has really gone mad at this point. I think we've reached a moment, and others have said it, where the degree of colonial viciousness that exists now in Israeli society and is supported by the West sends us back to 19th century barbarism, really, colonial barbarism. Israel is interested in affecting this kind of behavior within the U.S. Through major lobby influences and also cultural influences. As I said, it would be an amazing achievement if Zionists in the U.S. and outside it would actually say to a single Palestinian, I am sorry, just once. This has not happened in 100 years. It has happened, of course, on an individual level. I have Jewish friends and colleagues who have said it because we are all human, and there is no monolithic collective anywhere. But I think that one of the things we need to do is to begin to shift the language that speaks of the Palestinian and to allow for more Palestinian presence in the American consciousness beyond death and dying. It seems to me that Palestinians in the West are only alive when they are dying. And that is abhorrent and unacceptable. And that is part of a settler colonial mentality that only humanizes its subjects when they are limp, near dying, completely helpless, obedient, any sense of resistance or rise toward freedom or liberation is denied them through dehumanizing language and manipulative approaches and processes.
Fadi Judah, we want to thank you so much for spending this time with us. Palestinian-American writer, poet, translator, and physician, speaking to us from Houston. Dozens of his family members have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. We'll link to your recent piece for LitHub, A Palestinian Meditation in a Time of Annihilation. Coming up, we'll look at last night's Republican debate, which Donald Trump skipped again. Stay with us.
Lying, cheating, hurting, that's all you seem to do. Messing around every guy in town.
Is going to come by Led Zeppelin here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
On Wednesday night, the Republican Party held its third presidential debate in Miami. Former President Donald Trump refused to take part and opted to hold a nearby rally. Five Republicans were on stage: Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, former South Carolina Governor and U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, and biotech investor Vivek Ramaswamy. The debate began with a question about Israel. This is NBC's Lester Holt.
As President of the United States, what would you be urging Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to do at this moment? Governor DeSantis.
I would be telling Bibi, finish the job once and for all with these butchers, Hamas. They're terrorists. They're massacring innocent people. They would wipe every Jew off the globe if they could. He cannot live with that threat right by his country. The Hamas should release every hostage, and they should unconditionally surrender. I'm sick of hearing the media. I'm sick of hearing other people blame Israel just for defending itself. We will stand with Israel in word and in deed, in public and in private.
Ambassador Haley, what would you do? What would you be urging Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to do? Would you consider humanitarian pause, for example?
The first thing I said to him when it happened was, I said, finish them. Finish them. And the reason is, I worked on this every day when I was at the United Nations. And we have to remember that they have to, one, eliminate Hamas, two, support Israel with whatever they need, whenever they need it, and three, make sure we bring our hostages home. We need to be very clear-eyed to know there would be no Hamas without Iran. There would be no Hezbollah without Iran. There would not be the Houthis without Iran, and there wouldn't be the Iranian militias in Syria and Iraq that are trying to hit our military men and women if it hadn't been for Iran. And who is funding Iran right now? China is buying oil from Iran. Russia is getting drones and missiles from Iran, and there is an unholy alliance. We need to be clear-eyed. The last thing we need to do is to tell Israel what to do. The only thing we should be doing is supporting them and eliminating Hamas. It is not that Israel needs America. America needs Israel. They are the tip of the spear when it comes to this Islamic terrorism, and we need to make sure that we have their backs in that process.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Ramaswamy,
Mr. Ramaswamy, any daylight between you and the candidates we just heard on this issue on what you would tell the prime minister?
Not in terms of what I would tell the prime minister, no. In fact, I would go one step further. The founding vision of Israel was based on the idea that they don't want to depend on anybody else's sympathy or direction in defending themselves. So what I would tell Bibi is that Israel has the right and the responsibility to defend itself. I would tell him to smoke those terrorists on his southern border, and then I'll tell him as president of the United States, I'll be smoking the terrorists on our southern border.
That was biotech investor Vivek Ramaswamy at last night's Republican debate. Before that, Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis. We're joined now by Matt Duss. He is executive vice president at the Center for International Policy. He is the former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. Matt, why don't you start off by your overall response to this debate, its emphasis on foreign policy, and particularly this beginning on Israel and Gaza?
How do I start? I mean, I have to confess I didn't watch the entire debate because I felt the intelligence being sucked from my body as I tried to listen to what these folks were saying, and even just hearing those clips you just played, I think my IQ dropped several points. I mean, these people don't understand foreign policy. This is just kind of knuckle dragging hawkishness to feed their base. I think it's an embarrassment. It's frankly inhumane to talk about foreign policy this way as thousands of Palestinians are being massacred in Gaza. It will not keep Israel safe. It will certainly not keep the United States safe. So that's what I have to say about that.
And Matt Duss, I mean, if you could elaborate on some of the things that they said, not just the candidates said, not just about Gaza, but also about the rest of the world. I mean, there was some kind of consensus, at least on social media, that if any of these people are elected, the U.S. will effectively be at war with several countries, including China, Russia, Iran, and so on. So if you could if you could talk about that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you heard Haley just now basically sketching out the new axis of evil, China, Russia, Iran, that she, as president, I mean, clearly she won't be the nominee, but she could potentially be a vice presidential nominee under Trump, who will, of course, be the candidate. But she would lead us, she's proposing to lead the United States into yet another global war on terror, after the previous 20-year war on terror that this administration, has been trying to wind down, with some success, but some failures. I mean, I think their approach to the Gaza war has frankly been, atrocious. But yeah, that's what we saw. I mean, there was really no policy. I think you just saw signaling and rhetoric, that was frankly barbaric, and I think it's very concerning that this is the state of the debate in one of the country's two major parties.
Matt, I want to go to an excerpt of your former boss, Senator Bernie Sanders. He was on CNN Sunday when he was interviewed by Dana Bash.
I want to just clarify one thing, Senator, if I might. You support a humanitarian pause in Gaza. Some of your fellow progressives say that there should be a full-on ceasefire, which would require an agreement on both sides to halt the fighting. Do you support a ceasefire? And if not, why not?
Well, I don't know how you can have a ceasefire, permanent ceasefire, with an organization like Hamas, which is dedicated to turmoil and chaos and destroying the state of Israel. And I think what the Arab countries in the region understand, that Hamas has got to go.
That clip was later shared by AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Matt, you worked for Senator Sanders. She pushed him on a ceasefire. He said he was for a pause, but wouldn't go so far as a ceasefire. Your thoughts?
No, I think the senator has been one of the strongest voices for a cessation of violence, for stopping the bombing. These are the words he used in his speech on the floor of the Senate a couple weeks ago. He has been one of the strongest voices in the country, raising the issue of the Palestinians who are dying. And even before October 7, he was one of the strongest voices pressing the U.S. government to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. So I understand there are some of my colleagues on the left who've been pushing for, you know, to use the word ceasefire. I get that. I think what the senator said there about the challenges of a ceasefire being negotiated with an organization like Hamas are valid. where my focus is, and I think I would encourage people to focus, is on stopping the bombing. A humanitarian pause is something the Biden administration has already called for, said they support. They need to get their diplomatic weight behind that. They have not done that yet. They are still not using the leverage our country has with Israel to stop the bombing. And that's where I think the focus should be.
Well, I also want to ask you about the House of Representatives' vote Tuesday to censure Michigan Democrat Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian-American member of Congress. 22 Democrats joined Republicans in backing the resolution. Tlaib addressed her colleagues on the House floor Tuesday.
Trying to bully or censor me won't work because this movement for a ceasefire is much bigger than one person. It's growing every single day. There are millions of people across our country who oppose Netanyahu's extremism and are done watching our government support collective punishment and the use of white phosphorus bombs that melt flesh to the bone. They are done watching our government, Mr. Chair, supporting cutting off food, water, electricity, and medical care to millions of people with nowhere to go. Like me, Mr. Chair, they don't believe the answer to war crimes is more war crimes.
So that was Rashida Tlaib speaking just before the House voted to censure her. Your response, Matt Duss, and in general, how this fits into the kind of silencing of pro-Palestinian voices in the U.S.
I mean, I thought the censure was absolutely shameful. When one considers the crazy things that members of Congress say all the time, just wild, wild stuff. I used to work in Congress. I know I would hear it all the time. The idea that this comment from this member of Congress is worthy of censure, that 22 Democrats would join in censuring their colleague, the one Palestinian in Congress at a time when thousands of Palestinians are being killed, I think is shameful.
Let me ask you this, Matt Duss. More than 300 Ukrainian scholars, artists, and activists have signed a letter expressing solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. They write, Palestinians have the right to self-determination and resistance against Israel's occupation, just like Ukrainians have the right to resist Russian invasion. The letter standing in stark contrast to the president, Zelensky, who was going to Israel, apparently, but when those plans leaked, he canceled those plans. Your response?
I think that's right. And as a Ukrainian American, I also stand in solidarity with people under occupation. The Palestinians are facing a much more powerful neighbor, the Israelis, who are in many ways trying to do to the Palestinians what Russia is trying to do to Ukraine, which is snuff out them as an existing nation. Putin does not recognize Ukrainian nationhood. It does not see Ukraine as a legitimate state. Netanyahu feels the same way about Palestinians. His governing partners feel the same way about Palestinians. Now, certainly in resisting occupation, you know, the Palestinians, as Ukrainians, need to follow international law. There should not be attacks on civilians. The attacks of October 7th were atrocious. They were terrorism. They were heinous. Israel has the right and responsibility to respond and to defend its people. But the parallel here is between two peoples facing occupation, two peoples trying to secure their own rights and self-determination. That's not to say the two situations are identical in all senses, but I do appreciate the sentiments expressed in that letter.
Matt Duss, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Vice President at the Center for International Policy, former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. As we wrap up, we want to wish a very happy birthday to Diana Pera, and congratulations to our crew member, Matt Ealy, and his partner, Zara. Welcome to the world, Zyron Carliz Benola Ealy. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Gesder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkaf, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Sanji Lopez, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, I mean Goodman Nermin.
Broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, this is CJSF 90.1 reminding you to stay safe and that through campus community radio, you can let CJSF 90.1 listeners know about an important community event or a public service. Email your information to cjsfpsa@sfu.ca. That was cjsfpsa@sfu.ca. Let us know the where, the when, and the how, and we can take it from there. We would love to help your community service have a wider public engagement. Remember, email cjsfpsa@sfu.ca.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.